this talk is really collaborative work with my colleagues, primarily Anders Hansen, whom I will list for basic correspondence since I will be moving from Los Alamos in a short time, and the other people in my group. And I also have to thank the people from Los Alamos that are now at Virginia Bioinformatics Institute. Mara Marate was supposed to speak yesterday, sadly couldn't do that. Really, this project started by a couple of those people, and we worked together, and this is to a certain extent a continuation of that work. So what I will do is I will give a little bit of background in the kind of simulations that are done at Los Alamos, primarily transims and episims. I will talk about random graph models for social networks and activity networks, primarily the so-called Aiello-Chengdu model, and our version of this model that I call the multi-label generalization. I will present some of the results on activity analysis that we've done in order to be used for this type of model, and I will finish up with some conclusions. So what this discrete simulation sciences group at Los Alamos has been doing over the years is build massive multi-agent simulations of infrastructures such as Transims, which is a traffic simulation that was developed. It was a 10-year multi-million project for Department of Transportation. And EpiSims, which is a newer simulation of disease propagation in an urban environment. Basically, things like smallpox and flu as well. So Transims, as I said, is a massive multi-agent simulation of traffic based on a pedestrian movement which uses a cellular automaton model, the so-called Nagel-Treckenberg model, and it's already a mature project. It's been commercialized and licensed by the Department of Transportation to IBM and deployed to the Portland Metropolitan Authority. You simulate traffic at seconds resolution levels and 7 meters and individual movers, and you have very detailed information on a particular characteristics of a given mover. You could know, for instance, things about his age, his income, destination. This population comes on from a household survey that was done in Portland, Oregon, where each house, there were about 6,000 households. You collected demographics and activity information for a day, and the model had about 1.5 million people. They were created. Basically, it was a synthetic population that had the correct marginal distributions for the observables, and that you have capabilities for multimodal planning. You can combine ways to take routes in the city and various means of transportation, carpool, things like that. You have the algorithm works by the initialization phase uses an iterative assignment of people to roads, and you do a reassignment based on observed values as long as you try to convert to a sort of user equilibrium. Needless to say, this is a really slow process, and I've seen the recent papers in Transportation Journal that basically just try to speed up the process of converging to an equilibrium in transims. And this, the outcome of such an assignment could be for a family a sequence of schedules. So for instance, you have an adult that goes from home to work using carpool and then to home, a second individual, home, shopping, sharing a car with a kid that goes to daycare, and maybe you have another kid that goes to school using a bus. And it is this co-location of activities that creates a social network. So people can meet with other people in a certain location, and they interact with, and that does create a social network. One way to view, though, transom's outcome is basically a list where you give a person ID, a location ID, an activity type, a start time, and an end time. So for instance, I go to work from 9 to 5. Well, that's not exactly me, but that's another story. And person, then if he goes to location 2, does activity 2, and so forth. And this is a kind of data that we're going to be using. And in a nutshell, what we want to do is create analytical models that would generate such a list of activities for people. One point to take from this is that, at least for disease propagation purposes, all that matters is a social network. If I'm in contact with someone for a certain period of time, and they might, if I am infected, then I can transmit that to the other person. So the whole simulation, at least for epidemiological purposes, and we have seen an indication that there is some isomorphism between epidemiology and crime, you can, the whole simulation is basically set up to just produce implicitly the social network, and then you run a disease propagation mechanism on that social network. So this is precisely what I was talking about. You can view this as an activity network as an input to a multi-agent simulation, where you, that creates a bipartite graph with people on one side and locations on the other side. And of course, people and people can interact with people by being co-located. In the case of Portland, this people location graph creates a people graph. It has 1.6 million people, 250,000 locations. You have a number of edges, and you have indirect action by co-location. Say, for instance, in this case, PA interacts with PC at a certain time, and then PB interacts with PC. And if PA was sick, then you can infect PB via this this interaction. Now, what I presented and the discussion I had about calibration tells you that such large-scale simulations have a number of inherent problems. They rely on survey data, and most of the time it's incomplete. You have to make it up to some extent. Scenario specification, just putting the initial conditions into such a simulation, is a costly activity. Calibration takes a very long time. You cannot, more importantly, you cannot develop normative policies if you want, if you'd like to apply from this particular situation to another particular, you know, to a more general set of scenarios. It's, to a certain extent, the fact that you have a given input condition and a given street infrastructure constrains you. So you'd like to do something that would be a little bit more general. All these factors have one consequence. If you would really like to do fast turnaround studies using transims, which is what the promise of the project was all about, this is extremely difficult. And I've actually seen, you know, there are various metropolitan associations that have conducted feasibility studies, and that was their conclusion, that you shouldn't implement transims because it's difficult. Now, what the project was set up to do is provide a sort of lightweight, approximate version to it. And the idea was to create parametric models of activity networks. Activity networks are like the graphs I described before, labeled by time and by the type of activity that you're doing. And you want to generate synthetic activity schedules, run the simulation on the social network. And the context of this, there is a significant amount of work in the social science literature on activity modeling. This is just one example. And we want to be, you know, to take advantage of those techniques. Of course, what one disadvantage of going to a network model compared to running an agent-based simulation is that basically emergent behavior is just coded in. I was looking at some NHTS data, and you can see an increase in traffic times around the morning commute. Something like that would be put in if you were to create a model of a network model. So I've described on one hand the approach. Now, why would you want to go to network models of activities? Well, there are certain, it's more quantitative than in many other areas of social science, and you start having metrics of network structure that you can take a look at and identify factors that are important. So the assumption behind the model like this is some sort of low model. You want a model of low complexity, a model with few parameters. So in order to do so, you have to have an assumption of cultural similarity to a certain extent, and some macroscopic characteristics should show a large degree of correlation in order to be able to do anything generic. And I've heard the phrase that I like a lot at this conference. The routines of daily living should be the ones that would be more generic. The starting point of this was a paper by Eubank and others. They were studying the social network that that arises from transim simulation without taking into account activities and start time and time, aggregated over the whole 36-hour, I think. And what they showed is that the so-called Aiello-Chung-Liu model in random graph theory can replicate some network characteristics. And this has implications for epidemics. I'll describe that model, but the idea is the following. Suppose you want to break that graph. And you break the graph by deleting high degree nodes. The Aiello-Chung-Liu model with that range of parameters that we're studying is what is so-called an expander graph. It has high expansion, which means that you'll have to eliminate a lot of high degree nodes before the connected component shrinks to a significant degree. So in other words, the network structure has negative implications for the policy of containing an epidemics by isolating the high degree nodes. And I promised, this is my one slider of random graph models, and I'll describe the last model afterwards for those of you that aren't doing random graph theory. Basically, you have a lot of models. The simplest one is the Erdős-Reni, where basically everyone is connected to everyone independently with a given probability. Of course, that's not very realistic as a model of social interaction. Another version is a so-called configuration model, which controls the number of interactions that a given node in the network has, and you can think of as having stubs and connecting stub, giving each node a fixed number of stubs and connecting those stubs uniformly at random. And the Aiello-Chung-Liu model trades the approximation for in degree sequence for better mathematical properties, and it has a sort of GNP-like flavor in the sense that each edge is put independently. And the way it works is that you specify a degree distribution, you specify the number of edges each node has, and I'm giving here the bipartite version of the graph because that's what we're interested in, people locations. And given a node on the left-hand side and a node on the right-hand side, you put an edge between them with probability proportional to the product of their degrees. And there is a normalization factor in there that will take care of that. What you're getting with this, you're not getting exact degree distribution, but it's much easier to study mathematical properties and to generate. So for the transims data, again, this is the social network that was created by running transims on Portland population. It's not real data. What they were looking at is that, in effect, if you measure certain characteristics, so-called small graphlets, The number of such graphlets is well approximated by the number of such graphlets in the corresponding Aiello-Chung-Lu model, where the number of edges for a person is roughly exponential, and the number of edges for a location, it has a certain regime where it's powerful. I personally would not think this is a good example of a power law, but that was what they claimed. At least there is some regime where that happens. And a benefit of this is that you have fast generation algorithms for the channel model, even faster than the naive method. So to give you an example, the whole transims calibration was taking a few days. Running the naive algorithm, a generation algorithm, takes about 10 hours. And there is another algorithm that does block generation that can generate random samples in under a minute at the expense of providing an approximate degree distribution. Now, all this does not have any information. It's only edges. You don't have activities. You don't have start times and end times. So these are some of the weaknesses of the model. Of course, if you think how real life works, and if you would like to turn this one into a model of real activity networks, there are other things that you should capture. People's activities are, you could probably think that they're they fall in a certain class of activity schedules based on demographic information and whatnot. On one hand, so you have to represent the fact that you have this clustering in activity schedules. On the other hand, you do not represent hierarchical structure. Even not thinking about geography for now, but if you live in a certain area of a town, you're not equally likely to go to any place in town to perform an activity. So there has to be some hierarchical structure that would take that into account. And what I want to talk about is a very simple idea for extension based on essentially multi-levels. And the idea is that instead of a single edge type, I will put multiple edge types. And the edge types or labels will reflect activity types and activity information. One problem that you have to solve if you create a random graph model of this sort is activity consistency. You don't want to do two activities at the same time. So suppose you have, for now, not a person, but a household and the location. Maybe someone in that household would go to work from 9 to 5. Some other member would go from 9 to 3. Some other member would go from would work in at night. And suppose you have identified label types for the activity types in such a way that if you were to represent the activity of a given person, the activity labels, of course, they would be consistent. A random graph model that would have this information, that would be have multiple labels, would solve the time consistency problem implicitly because the input data that you're calibrating your model against would be consistent. So I've described before what I'm doing, and for each activity class, I want to use the configuration model and the algorithm that I alluded to, the one that you can generate fast samples from the Chung-Lu model, you can extend it to a multi-label version. So now the question is, how do you choose the labels? And we decided to take a look at real data, not transims data. And what we did, we analyzed three data sets, the National Household Transportation Survey, one from Chicago and one from Houston. The problem is, these data sets have all sorts of inconsistencies. They don't have activity types that are compatible. It's hard to say, I want to capture this activity in one survey and this activity in another survey. So we did a part of intersection. But there are certain core activities, like work, for instance, and you can see here a clustering of work activity by start time, end time. So the x-axis is start time, the y-axis is end time, and the contour plots are logarithmic. So the ones that are darker have really way more people performing activities in those times. And you can kind of see that you have three major clusters, roughly two corresponding to morning and afternoon work, and one corresponding roughly to uninterrupted work for the whole day. And kind of similar patterns happen in each of these. We have a statistical analysis and things of this sort. Kind of similar behavior happens, so this is another one, another activity, home, that has similar behavior over all three of these. And there are some cases, for instance, education, in which there are certain clusters that are not significant on the national survey, and that's probably because Chicago would probably have a larger, I don't know, maybe university population or there is some factor that you study more in the evening in that data compared to the national data. On the other hand, there are other activities whose clustering looks nowhere near as the ones that we've seen for work. So if you take the activity of surf passenger, and this is a easy and important distinction between what I would call anchor and anchored activities, relates to trip chaining and relates to the fact that some activities are performed, you know, like work from 9 to 5. They have a more or less defined range in which you aim to perform them, while some other activities, you perform them in support of other activities. So they're dependent on another one. So for instance, you get back to, you go back home after you've stopped work. So that would be an example of an anchored activity. And you have to take into account these dependencies when you're choosing those labels. And roughly speaking, it's only the anchor activities that will be labels in the bipartite extension that I was talking about. And for the anchored activities, you have to do a different mechanism, and what we're doing is basically a decision tree model. But that is the lesson. The lesson is that you have to first identify what the anchor activities is. So let's look a little bit, and I've chosen the work activity for as an example. This is done over a much larger set of activities, and we do have results of this sort for every activity. So we're looking now at Chicago data, work activity for based on the number of time a person does an activity. Again, this comes from the survey. So the survey is basically a list. I go to work from this to this time, and maybe I go to lunch. And what you can see, and we'll see it even better in the next slides, is that for people that work only once, there is a fairly well-defined cluster that would correspond roughly to what you would think of normal work time. For people that work twice, the clusters are, the two most important clusters are the ones that would correspond to work before and after lunch. And we've actually done, we've applied k-means clustering to this data set, and we chose a number of clusters in such a way that to optimize this within group sums of squares criterion, so we don't put too many clusters. And what's happening is that for work that is uninterrupted, you basically, the optimal number of clusters is 3 times. For people that go to work twice, you have 4 clusters, and the start and end times are basically the centroids of the clusters. And if you look at work twice activities, and remember there were 4 clusters before, and I listed the centroids on top, The most important one is you work in the morning and have a break, and then you work in the afternoon as expected. There are other ones like work all day, roughly, and or work a significant percentage of the day and then work in the evening. But also, if you look at the diagonal, there are clusters where there are activities where you do two consecutive activities in the same cluster. That basically means that you've only it's not a linear ordering of the activities. What you've done is maybe I've interrupted the activity and then I restarted. So even though in the survey you have a person is doing two activities, so if you think of the graph model, you would be inclined to view it as putting two edges for it, doing two works and worrying about that. What's really going on is that it's really a single work activity that is interrupted. So that's another of the message of looking at the data, is that you shouldn't take, the representation shouldn't be a linear ordering of activities the way surveys provide, but we use a tree-like model for that. You can do the same thing for work three times and more than that, and the most popular the most popular cluster here is something like take a 15-minute break around 10 a.m. and an hour break at lunchtime. And the more clusters you have, the more work activities you have, the better the fit to essentially an exponential distribution of lengths of work activities you have, and of yes. Yeah, this one is duration of each work activity for people that work once, for people that work twice, three times, four times.
Those are hours or minutes or?
They're hours. But again, if you work two times, then you interrupt, you know, your work schedule might be 8 hours, but you interrupt it. You know, you do it in two pieces.
For people that work three times, there's an awful lot of them that are working very, very short, sort of short bursts. They're even admitting to it on the survey.
The point is that for the more you have, the better you can approximate, you know, basically beyond four work activities, you don't need to worry about it. You can fit basically an exponential distribution for the times there. And what if you work two times? And you compare the two times, so you have a break in between. Distributions are kind of similar. The mean is actually smaller. I don't know if you can see 390 versus 378. And the statistical test between the duration of the first work activity and the duration of the second work activity shows that those two are uncorrelated, or the statistical test basically cannot pick up any correlation between the two. So if you want to model time duration. Now, what is the most important predictor of how long you work? And we did a regression, and it turns, basically in this picture we have activity duration versus start time. And not surprisingly, as before, you can see the two most important clusters and the one cluster here. And the result of a regression analysis shows that for people that work twice, the start time and the intercept are important, but the first work duration is not. And for people that work three times, the main factor is the starting time of the current activity. So in other words, the most important factor of deciding the length of an activity is when you start it. It's not as much what you've done in the past, it's just when you start it. So, what I have tried to describe is our work in activity clustering, and we have many more results than the ones that I presented, basically all sorts of activities and models. As I said, the labels are classes of anchor activities, We try to model the joint distribution of activity start times and activity duration. We've made this distinction between anchored activities and anchor activities, and the fact that activities can be interrupted. And this is important for a part of our work where I will not present results. I will just describe the approach, and that is in clustering activity patterns. And there is previous work in doing that. For instance, there is a recent paper by Gulias and his collaborator. Essentially what he does is he breaks down an activity schedule over 10-minute intervals, and then takes, essentially, you have 144 length binary words, and you take Hamming distance between them, and you do a clustering. Now, I have argued that before that since activities are interrupted, that is not a good model for a distance. So what we've tried to develop is a different metric between activity schedules that takes into account the fact that you might do another activity like slightly shifted in time, but if you have home lunch work schedule, and the lunch schedule is shifted in time, that is suddenly much closer than something that where you would not do lunch or you would do a totally random activity. And we are implementing a partition algorithm, so that would take care of the clustering. The other part that we had to do is model location degrees by activity. Sadly, this data, all these three surveys, have very little data on the location side. It's too sparse to infer anything meaningful. So we just resorted to analyzing transims data disaggregated by activity type and also by time intervals. And for certain activities, for instance, for work, you need degree counts. Results of Eubank and others, you can the aggregate degree has a similar flavor to the one that you have for the total number of activities, and it's more complicated for other types of activities in the survey. But for the basic ones, home and work, you can view the exponential. And this one, a colleague of mine is arguing that there is a statistical model, like a mixture of power laws, that basically models this one better. And he's done some preliminary work in that, but I won't present here. Finally, what we're doing for modeling community structure is something that is actually related to work of Aaron Closet, Chris Moore, and Mark Newman. Basically, you have to identify a hierarchical model, and what they did was done in the context of just networks. You have a dendrogram, and each bottom node represents a cluster, and there is a probability, a different probability of putting edges between nodes in different clusters. And they had a model with learning the probabilities in a maximum likelihood mode and learning the dendrogram using a Markov chain Monte Carlo approach. Now, the Markov chain Monte Carlo approach is way too costly to do on the Portland data or any of this of the data that we're working on. So what we're doing is we're doing a similar thing using a Chengdu-like null model instead of GNP. And the dendrogram, one of our members has developed an energy-based clustering algorithm that we're using for community detection. So once you have the dendrogram, you infer edge probabilities by maximum likelihood. Also, remember that we've clustered people by activity schedules. So that gives you a way to quantify how many people of a different type are in a given cluster of a town. So what we're also learning is not only the edge probabilities, but community characteristics. In conclusion, I've outlined some work on extending the Aiello chain loop model to a full activity generator. It's not completed, but when completed, hopefully it could serve as a synthetic activity generator. We've presented some data in support of that cultural similarity notion, and we've extended that algorithm, the generation algorithm, to the multi-label model, which was one of the main requirements of this work, was that you still preserve computational efficiency, that you can generate activity networks pretty fast. And this is a list of things that we would like to do. The one that is most interesting is whether you can look at real data and the social network and somehow identify, look infra geography from community structure. So presumably, if you take data from a real city and just look at the patterns of interaction, you might be able to tell that two neighborhoods are closer together than two far away neighborhoods or things of that sort. So this would be an interesting thing to do, as well as, of course, the ultimate feature, which is running dynamics, disease propagation dynamics on the model, and compare it with epicenters. Thanks.